The following is a class given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on May 17, 1990. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 10, Verse 14.
By His Divine Grace, Srila Abhayachandaravinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. By seeing their faces, one whose body has been pricked by pins can understand the pain of others who are pin-pricked. Realizing that this pain is the same for everyone, he does not want others to suffer in this way. But one who has never been pricked by pins cannot understand this pain. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. There is a saying, the happiness of wealth is enjoyable by a person who has tasted the distress of poverty. There is also another common saying, Vandya ki bhujive phasa vedana. A woman who has not given birth to a child cannot understand the pain of childbirth. Unless one comes to the platform of actual experience, one cannot realize what is pain and what is happiness in this material world. The laws of nature act accordingly. If one has killed an animal, one must himself be killed by that same animal. That is called mangsa. Mam means me, and sa means he. As I am eating an animal, that animal will have the opportunity to eat me. In every state, therefore, it is ordinarily the custom that if a person commits murder, he is hanged. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta Swami, translation purport to text 14, chapter 10, canto 10 of the Srimad Bhagavatam in the matter of deliverance of the Yamalarjuna trees, Sri Narada Muni is giving his reasons why he is going to destitute the two sons of Kuvera for their offensive activities. He's going to make them bankrupt materially. But in the act of doing so, he's going to spiritually make them very wealthy. So he's giving the reasons why being impoverished can also have his good features. If someone's very wealthy, they become very proud and they don't see things as they are. So that by returning them to poverty, then they actually see how painful life is, how painful it is to be in poverty. This makes them lose their false ego and forces them to be more humble, accept things as they come, instead of thinking that one's always in control of the situation. So here in this verse it gives the example that if someone was picked with pins, and you see another person being picked with a pin and making the grimace, making the face, you can understand what kind of pain that person is suffering because you already got picked one time. But if someone never was picked with a pin, even the person makes the face, you can't relate with it. What is actually that person feeling? Many Prabhupada gave many examples. What it is to go through childbirth, how can someone know? A woman who's never had children, she may theoretically think she knows, but she will not be able to know. So many examples of that. Actually, in India, one sees how there's a lot of mutt, stray dogs around. And sometimes people throw hot water on the tea stalls, they throw hot water on the stray dogs. And when the scalding water hits the dog, and it, wah! Anyone who's been burned, and you can also understand that the dog is feeling the same burning pain as if you dumped a thing of hot water on your foot. But sometimes to scare the dogs away, they smack the dog with a big stick. The dogs hang around the tea stalls and bother everybody. Then when you hit the dog, it also cringes and makes a certain whining sound, screaming sound, whatever. If anyone's ever been hit, then you can understand, well, he's feeling the same kind of pain. Actually, in this material world, human beings have an opportunity to become God conscious. And that's the real special feature of this body. But as far as material experiences go, the pains that the human body feel are not categorically different than the pains that the dogs or other animals feel. Similarly, the pleasures are not categorically different. It may be a little qualitative or, depending on the person, quantitative difference of different types of pain or pleasure. But categorically, the basic experience of pain and pleasure is not different. That's why in the Bhagavatam, we are instructed that why should we make our life based on trying to get the same kind of happiness that vidbhujan, that even dogs and pigs are able to get, even the eaters of stool. Of course, in the West, dog is considered man's best friend. They will probably worship the dog. You see in India how sometimes even the dogs go and eat excrement on the side of the road. And recently in Hyderabad, when I was there, Prabhupada said, when the dog looks at your face, sometimes they're wagging their tail, looking at your face, thinking how nice it would be to eat your nose. The nose is a very tender, sweet taste, delicacy for the dogs. So in Hyderabad, there was a big case that something was coming in and eating all the people's faces in the morgue. So then they found that one day the guy hid and found that some dog was able to climb into the window, under the door, just to get through a hole in the wall. Somehow he could find in there, and there was a dead body of some 11-year-old girl, and was going right for the face and eating the face and the nose. I remember what Prabhupada said. Then the guy came out and beat the dog to death. Then they decided to fix the hole in the wall. So these dogs, whatever pains or pleasure they're feeling, is not different than what we're experiencing in one sense. So why should we consider that this is that if we have this type of pain and pleasure, this is what's going to make us happy. We can have a nice material comfortable situation for the senses, then what happens? That Prabhupada explained that some astrologer said one of the previous prime ministers of India had taken rebirth as a white dog in a millionaire's house in Sweden, that he wanted a comfortable life, so this millionaire had two dogs, one black and one white, one male, one female. And so both of them had two servants that bathed them, rubbed them down with a brush, give them as much meat as they wanted to eat. They had a nice little dog house. They had everything they wanted, comfortable life, no anxiety, no anything, all they were served hand to foot. So this was what he wanted, this was the goal of his life, so next birth he took like that. He was a nice, well-kept pet dog. Of course, who could say what his next birth was? Who could challenge the astrologer? But according to what the statements of that person, that so-called prime minister, it might be true. The point is, no one knows what their next life is going to be. If we develop our desires in such a way that we'll be satisfied with a kind of animal, comfortable situation, that's what we'll get. If in us there's the overriding desire to achieve God consciousness, to be God realized, to actually transcend this, maybe now we are, by Krishna's mercy or by good karma, by whatever means, we may feel some relief, some comfort, but we shouldn't allow ourselves to become casual or nonchalant or careless. We shouldn't allow ourselves to turn down the accelerator on our progress back to home, back to God. And if we're giving some material relief, that's Krishna's mercy, so we can give more time for Krishna's service, more energy for Krishna's service. If the only thing which is going to make us serve Krishna more is being put in suffering, then we're going to force Krishna to put us more and more into suffering. And if we're put into, because we're praying to Krishna, make us Krishna conscious, at the same time if we have a comfortable situation, we can become a little bit lazy, then it's not good for our Krishna consciousness. So that's almost like asking Krishna, okay, put me in difficulty because it's the only way I'm going to serve you. That's practically what Kunti did. Of course, she didn't say that was the only way. They served all the time. But even Kunti said, better we can be put in difficulty if by difficulty we get your mercy than if by not having difficulty you're going to leave us. But it's not that Krishna has to leave you because the person is not in difficulty. If we spontaneously and self-motivatedly we engage ourselves in Krishna service, taking the opportunity of fair weather to, so to speak, make hay, or fair weather to actually go forward in our Krishna consciousness. Our goal, of course, is not to have just a comfortable situation, because that's all illusory. Today it's comfortable, tomorrow there's a cyclone, tomorrow there's disease, tomorrow there's something else, car accident, whatever, danger is there at every step. So you know that there's not any kind of comfort. Even the devas, these two sons of the demigods, they were enjoying like anything. They had so much comfort, no anxiety. Their father was Kuvera. But in this way, they're completely wasting their valuable life. From there, they'll then fall back down and become an animal, a human being. It's not a permanent situation that they remain as devas. So before they completely waste their life, Narada Muni gave them this curse, which is a blessing in disguise, so that they could actually become God conscious. They could perfect their lives. In the Bible, it says, as you sow, so shall you reap. This is the law of karma. For every action, there's a reaction. So this is very well understood by all the devotees. And our Krishna consciousness is not exactly karma. We're depending on Krishna's mercy. Karma goes on even by its own previous momentum. We'll suffer and joy according to our previous karma. But devotional service is something that we have to push ourselves. It's something which is transcendental to the law of karma. Mancha joga vicharina bhakti joga na sevate sagunan sumatita itam bhamavuraya kalpate. Therefore, it's not dependent on law of karma. It's dependent on our own enthusiasm, our own patience and determination, our own practice of devotional service. Whatever the material situation, we have to go on with our devotional service. If we let anything stand in our way and bring us down, then actually that's just to reveal to us our actual conditioned nature. That no matter what the situation, we have to remain fixed in our Krishna consciousness, in our dedication to serving Guru and Gauranga. So, also here Prabhupada explains the meaning of the word mansa. Mansa actually is a name in Sanskrit for meat. Mang means meat and sa means he. As I am eating an animal, the animal will have the opportunity to meet me. So the meaning of meat means, okay, I'm eating your flesh today. That means your next life you can eat my flesh. And when they have the ceremony of offering the goat to some demigoddess, like Kali, then a Brahmin, on behalf of the person who's having the goat sacrificed, he whispers in the goat's ear that today this person is taking your life, in the next life you can take his life. Of course, now people don't know the meaning of the mantra, so they can't do it mechanically, but that's actually what the meaning. So by eating meat, practically a person is eating his own flesh, because his flesh will be eaten in the future. If somebody understands that, then why he'll be so foolish ever as to want to eat meat, fish, eggs, etc., simply causing his own future flesh to be eaten. The Buddhists don't believe in God officially. Unofficially many do today, but the official philosophy is not God, it's voidism. But they can understand by the law of karma that whatever you do, you get the reaction. So the original teachings of Buddha are to be non-violent. He rejects all form of meeting. Modern Buddhists are also not strict in that. So, but the philosophy is like that. It's very clear in the Vedas that one should not eat meat for this reason. Especially not of an animal that's not to kill an animal. One time there was one sadhu who was some acharya. He got caught up in a drought in the desert. And he practically was dying. He was like crawling to get out of the desert. And then he came across a dog. Right before him, the dog died. It was a dead dog. He didn't kill it. It just died. He was about to die himself, so then he ate the dog meat for survival. He got out of the desert and he resumed his own Krishna consciousness. Sometimes people say, what if this, what if that, what if you're starving? But even then, he didn't kill the dog. The dog was already dead. Took it that Krishna gave him this to save himself. If there's some dire life and death circumstance, then the consideration. But nowadays, it might come up. But nowadays, you see, I've seen all over the world, even in the interior villages of India, and even in the deserts, and now in the Middle East, everywhere they're importing, you know, oranges from California, and oranges from different places, Australia, Israel. The fruits are available, vegetables are available, grains are shipped all over because of the whole international commerce. Practically speaking, there's nothing you can't get anywhere. At least in the Western world. I don't know. Might be more rough in the communist countries. But even there, the devotees are not having difficulty being vegetarians. There's not such a variety of vegetables in the winter. Actually, there's no difficulty today for someone not to eat meat. So it's understood that someone's eating because they're eating just for their sense gratification, just for their tongue, or because they're ill-informed, they don't know that what is the danger of eating it. So the devotees are actually, they're doing welfare for the, not only for the animals. My movements are there to save cruelty to animals. But the devotees realize that they're not only saving cruelty to animals, they're saving the pain for the people who are eating the animals, because they're going to also suffer in the future if they don't stop. When they harm the animals to get their meat, when they kill them, the same pain and fear that we would feel in the same situation, they're feeling similar pain, fear, distress. In India, two of the states, they only allow cow slaughter. In the other states, it's forbidden. So you see that sometimes you're driving down the road and they're herding the cows from one state to the next where they have a slaughterhouse. And normally you know how when people herd cows, they kind of move along. But these cows know that they're going to slaughter because they're always trying to run away and escape. And that you can see tears coming down their eyes. It's the most horrible thing to see. And these people have to beat the cow. The cows sometimes sit in the road, they won't go forward. They can just smell it from these people that they're out for no good. And the people beat them with sticks. It's like, it's really intolerable to watch them herd these cows to the slaughterhouse. In America, you don't see, they just put them in big, you know, railway or trucks. You don't see what happened. But here, they just herd them along the street. You can see how the cows really don't want to get slaughtered. They don't want to go with these people. By any means, they try to run away. And so they ran the cows or put some big paint on them so that if they run away, they can easily spot them. So these Nalakuver, Manigriva, they are very rich, but they became proud. Therefore, they had to be brought down to their humble position again so that they could understand things as they were. That's when Narada Muni is going to turn them from demigods into trees. So we should understand, learn from the mistakes of others. Manigriva and Nalakuver, they got a little wealth, they got proud, and they got some mercy to get pulled down. Actually, if they hadn't, they would have fallen down permanently by being pulled down by Narada Muni. They're actually becoming purified and get reestablished in real glory. Otherwise, by the laws of nature, they'll be completely finished anyway. So this is the situation that America has so much wealth, but gradually this is all going to become ruined if the people don't change their consciousness. If we are proud of wealth, that will destroy us. And generally when people are wealthy, they're proud. Now some of the big people in the world, they're facing a lot of difficulties. Some of these wealthy people comes in the paper off and on. Even they're rich and famous, some people get pneumonia, some people get wife, they get divorced, they don't. So many difficulties. So in this Kali Yuga, even a so-called wealthy person is not in control of his situation. He may be proud, but actually he's still suffering in so many ways. One of the things that is a caution that devotees, when they preach, they shouldn't become bewildered by the wealthy people in the world and think that, because if they think, wow, look at this person, he has a big house, he has a big car, has a big this, has a big that, he's so wealthy, wouldn't it be nice to have all these things? That if one starts to think in this way, it's actually a fall down from the spiritual platform. The devotees should guard against being bewildered by the material nature and thinking that the material nature is actually going to make us happy. Understand the material nature is a bad bargain. We want to make the best use of the bad bargain by being as Krishna conscious as possible, by being fully Krishna conscious, using the material energy in the service of Krishna, accepting whatever Krishna gives us as his mercy and using it in the best way possible in his service, regulating our material activities and continually reminding ourselves what is the real nature of the material world. In Vrindavani Bhajan, Prabhupada said that now I have seen the naked roop, the naked form of the material nature. That actually material life appears nice under certain conditions, but the conditions, if they change a little bit, all of a sudden friends and relatives, they leave someone if they don't have money, they don't care so much anymore. These difficulties are there. So if we're relying on material situations for our satisfaction, we're bound to be frustrated. If we rely on Krishna consciousness for our satisfaction, and we live without our material situations are as best we can, that is actually the formula. What satisfaction is there anyway in material life? Happiness and distress are always going to be following one after another. So no deep or permanent kind of satisfaction can be achieved by any material thing. It's always a flickering. So the devotees know that in material life there's no satisfaction. They also know there is satisfaction in Krishna consciousness. So the followers of Lord Chaitanya, they absorb their ambitions, their dreams, their higher energy in Krishna consciousness. And that material life is a maintenance factor that has to go on as long as we're in this world. But it's not, we don't put our hopes in that this material life is what's going to actually make us happy. See, the pure devotees are so much into pleasing Krishna that even when they experience ecstasy in serving Krishna, like in the nectar devotion, Daruka was fanning Krishna and he was getting so much ecstasy, his hands were shaking, his eyes were filled with tears, his voice was choked up. So actually it was disturbing his fanning of Krishna. His ecstasy was making him not be able to fan properly. He was feeling so much love for Krishna, so much ecstasy was coming, that his hand wasn't able to fan properly. So he became very angry at this ecstasy, why it was disturbing his service to Krishna. So the pure devotees, their objective is so much so to please Krishna, that even ecstasy is not their goal. Although they are experiencing the highest ecstasy, but their desire is simply that Krishna be pleased. And the more they want to please Krishna, then the more Krishna is pleased with them, and the more they are also feeling pleased because we're part of Krishna. In the previous verse also, Prabhupada quotes, that harava bhaktasya kuto mahat guna. And a Vaishnava never becomes a good man, however severely he is punished. That by the mercy of a Vaishnava, unless one is brought to the Vaishnava platform, one cannot be a good man. Great qualities will never be there in a non-devotee. But if someone is a devotee, then automatically all good qualities will come and take shelter. Unfortunately, modern society, they're trying to make educated people, trying to make productive people, trying to make good taxpayers, but they're not trying to make devoted people to God, to the Supreme Person. It's not an official policy. But that's the real thing which makes a good or great person. You say Kamsa was a great man, very powerful, but as soon as he heard his sister was going to have a child which would kill him, immediately he wanted to kill his sister in a second. Outgo all the good qualities. Just like that story about the jackal, that a paint can fell on the jackal and turned it blue. So all the animals in the jungle thought that it was a very unusual animal. So he declared himself to be the king of the jungle. And even the tiger and the lion who was normally the king of the jungle, he acceded to the blue animal because there was never a blue animal before, so he must be the king, royal blue. But that night when the other jackals were crying in the night, hoo hoo hoo, like hyenas, like coyotes, and all of a sudden that so-called blue king of the jungle, he couldn't resist, he also started to howl. Then the lion realized that this is an imposter, he's just a jackal. He jumped on him and killed him. So nature is like that. Someone may appear to be, because of some artificial accumulation of wealth or fame, as a very great person, but then as soon as some opportunity comes, they act just like a low-class person, reveal that they don't actually have any great qualities. As a Kali Yuga person is considered great just if he has money. That's considered aristocracy. Somebody somehow or another, by hook or by crook, he got some money, then he's considered an aristocrat. But previously in Vedic culture, it was considered a person was great as a brahmana, or as a kshatriya, or as a vaishya, even as a sudra, according to their particular qualities. But now it's simply, if you have money, you're great. If you're poor, you're bum. This is Kali Yuga. So the devotees, they may know that this is not the actual criteria. Having a good character, having good consciousness, all these things are, having Krishna consciousness, these are more important. Any questions?
You talked about in your life, you were explaining the law of karma, and also the story of the devotee in the desert, and how a dog. In the Bible, there's a story about Jesus feeding thousands.
According to some scholars, that he actually fed them bread. Some, they mistranslate that to say fish. Actually, what he did is feed them bread. That's what I heard. Any other question? So every word in Sanskrit has so much meaning. The word meat, mangsa. I and you. You're my food and I become your food.
How does that cycle end? In the sacrificing of the goat, we're explaining how. You know. So how does the cycle actually end?
What's the next step in the sacrifice?
You were explaining how in the sacrifice
of liability is there. Somewhere along the line, they can end up becoming food for that living entity.
You're also mentioning in India the cattle drive and how they do it. Is there any India is so strongly vegetarian?
Used to be.
Is there any active protest against
it? Some renowned spiritual leaders did fast to death. One person fast actually till he died, trying to get the cow slaughter banned in India. The problem is that India has about 20% or more Muslims, and other 1 to 2% Christians, and they eat meat. Officially, their religion doesn't, according to the way they interpret it today, doesn't ban it. So, as a secular government, India doesn't want to lose the minority, the politicians never want to lose the minority vote. I think the government makes money also on the slaughterhouses. So somehow the determination to actually implement in the Constitution, it said that it's a goal in the Constitution to have cow protection, to end cow slaughter. But the founders of the Indian Constitution did not have the determination or the force to actually implement it themselves. They put something, this is an objective, it should be done, but they didn't do it. So as a result, some states, most states have done it, but a few, if they don't want to, they don't. And Kerala specifically has a majority of Christian and Muslim and a minority of Hindus. So they have cow slaughter. But for instance, in Tamil Nadu, it's not, even there's prohibition, there's no alcohol allowed, there's no slaughter allowed. There's hardly any Muslims or Christians. In Bengal, there's 29% Muslim, because that was the capital of the Mughal Empire in the Eastern India, and the British capital. So somehow, they don't also force it. And most of the people there eat fish. They don't eat cows, actually. But only the Muslims eat cows. Hindus don't eat cows. Somehow they don't push it. So there's a movement, but in these two states, the movements don't really get off the ground so much. In the other states, they stopped it because the movements were more powerful. So hopefully by Lord Chaitanya's preaching expands again, then again, cow protection can be achieved in these places also. Hardly. Small percent. Of course, the point was that Muslims don't have to go to a slaughter. They can kill their own following their religious rituals. They have to buy it in a package or something. Buy it from a butcher shop. They have to do it, they can do it on their own. Why should it be institutionalized? If you have to do it on your own, it kind of discourages you from doing it very frequently. Actually, there's in the Quran, it states that you shouldn't kill a cow. That actually, cow meat is like poison for the eater. There's verses, one of my disciples found several verses where Hazrat Muhammad said one shouldn't eat cow meat. In general, it's better not to eat meat at all. I was thinking that maybe in America where the black Muslims are more philosophical and open, maybe here we can get those quotes and promote amongst them. They should all be vegetarian. We know the quotes in the Bible, Genesis, other places where it says that he's given you the grains and the seeds in the field to be your meat. You shouldn't eat anything with blood. You know how the Jews got around that by making kosher meat to drain out the blood from the animal. It's horrible. It's, I don't eat anything with blood. You know, then we don't eat anything that has blood. If it has sap or juice or some fruit juice, you know, they mean, but if it has blood, don't eat it. It doesn't mean you try to drain out all the blood. That means any living creature that has blood, fish, meat, eggs, it has blood in it. So you don't eat it. They created, you know. I know who the one that thought that went up. Where he is now.